relevant to the audience if we're wanting to mobilize them. So the questions, for example, about how do we integrate climate reporting into other things besides just the environmental beat? How do we integrate it into something other than the science? How do we talk about it in the food section, in the fashion section, in the real estate section, in the all the other sections that people are interested in, so that people feel like they have a way in? They feel like they have a way of understanding it. That's one crucial part. The other part also, I know that there's discussion about solutions journalism or constructive journalism. I'm not a journalist. I'm not part of those debates. But I do understand at least the idea that when people read, they need to have a feeling of their own agency. They need to have a feeling of their own sense of meaning. They need to have a feeling that what they do matters. And that is, again, I'm not part of the debates about solution journalism, but I am certain that will have a huge impact on how people approach the news and their ability to take in information. Again, we are living in a traumatizing world. That's not changing. That's not going to get better without more active people, without people doing all sorts of collective engagement. We cannot have people shut down. So the goal has to be, how do we develop and expand people's window of tolerance? How do we have a trauma-informed perspective? How do we treat ourselves carefully and gently? And how do we report in a way that keeps people engaged rather than shut down?
Yeah, that was great. Thanks, Rebecca. Excuse me. Gigi, you've spent a lot of time looking at how all of the things that Rebecca was talking about play out online. Can you jump in and talk a little bit about that and how it shows up and maybe how people might deal with it as well?
Sure. So thank you so much for that, Rebecca. And I think we cannot really talk about trauma and climate without talking about online abuse and safety. It's a very big part of the discussion that, yes, there is the general trauma of actually covering the environment and climate, and then there is some trauma that happens with the feedback and the things that happen online because covering the environment. So it's not only the field as all, but also the responses of people. Mm-hmm. And what journalists are facing when they're doing their jobs, when they're posting on Twitter, and like the things that they're receiving day in and day out. And this is very important to keep in mind because I come from a background in journalism covering human rights abuses, and there was like covering the topic is hard and traumatizing, and then the experience that you have after you cover and like publish your work is another type of trauma. Like it's just like keeps compounding and adding to the trauma. And one of the things that Rebecca mentioned was like the newsrooms. This is a big thing. This is like very big part of what we're trying to do, that to advocate for a newsrooms to have like this care and mental well-being and psychological well-being for their journalists and staff and freelancers. Because if you want people to keep doing the job, you really need to take care of them. Like no one can keep doing that. Burnout is real. And we're seeing it a lot now, way more than before. But also like, why would I, if I'm a journalist covering something and I receive a lot of online abuse, threats of sexual abuse, threats of physical abuse and violence, what is the thing that would keep me going? Already the topics we're covering are very hard, but then also we need support because the responses are becoming more and more violent. And I think I want to just start by defining what online abuse is. And the way we talk about it is that it's the repeated or severe targeting of an individual or group online through harmful behavior. And this can take a lot of different ways. And when we're defining it, we say repeated and severe for two main reasons, is that it doesn't have to be something only that is like very big tactic that is like, for example, doxing. Someone publishing my home address, asking others to go harm me. This is like very terrifying for someone to have access to that and to do that. And this can be only one incident, but it's really traumatizing. Mm. The other part of it is the repeated. When we talk about repeated, it's very important to point out that for incidents, they don't have to be like as doxing for them to count as online abuse. If I am receiving hundreds and hundreds of emails a day, people, which is a tactic that is very well known, people subscribing me on porn sites or other things that I did not choose, for me to keep receiving these hundreds of emails to the point that I lose access to my device or access to information that is important, this also is abuse. And the tactics are so many. I'm going to mention like just a few, and then we can have a discussion about them later. There are some of the things that we see journalists also worried about is online impersonation, which is someone creating a fake account, using your picture, using your name, pretending to be you, publishing horrible stuff just to get you in trouble, to get you fired, or to discredit you. And there is a huge gendered aspect to that as well. So this is an addition, like it's another layer of things that journalists have to worry about, or also have to have hard conversations with newsrooms and colleagues about. Because not all newsrooms deal with this in a way that is, oh, this is a malicious act and they're targeting the journalist. Some newsrooms just believe. And they don't do like this, they're part of like actually having a discussion. Another thing is that we see a lot is the spread of non-consensual intimate imagery. And some people call it revenge porn, but we really don't like using that term because it's not porn. Could be for revenge. People, someone hating what you covered or published. But this is also have a very big gendered aspect of it. And it's also to discredit, depending on who you are, depending on your background, your identity, your intersectional identities. All of this plays a role in adding a traumatic experience and stress to the journalists. One of the other things when it comes to online abuse and trauma is that, unfortunately, it hasn't been taken seriously. And it wasn't. Now the conversation is shifting. We were just talking about this. The conversation is shifting within newsrooms and with journalists, but it's slow. Like, for me, I wish it changes faster than this. I have worked in newsrooms before that. When we talk about online abuse, threats of rape, threats of sexual violence, threats of killing, and, like, very graphic and detailed things that people receive. And it's just like, it wasn't a thing that they took seriously, because for them, if you're not covering a conflict, you're not at risk. It's not a threat, which is not correct. Like, it's not. It's definitely traumatizing. This is one aspect of it. But also, it's impossible to keep things on Twitter. It's impossible. There is no way to disconnect what happens online from offline anymore. There was a survey done by ICFJ, I believe, that surveyed women journalists around the world, 70% of which said that they've encountered online violence during the course of their work. And 20% of them said that they have faced like offline violence or physical threats based or linked on things that they've received online. So this is a terrifying experience. And the U.S. is one of the very few countries, one of the very, very few countries in the world that has something called data brokers, or people find their websites. I know that a lot of journalists use it to actually find people and resources, sources and stuff like that, but it's also is used against journalists. So they are websites that collect information from the internet, package it, and sell it to people for less than a dollar. And that can have home addresses, that can have relatives linked, type of cars you have, phone numbers, like personal phone numbers, personal emails, places you've lived in like maybe 10 years ago or live in now. So just having this knowledge is terrifying. But the reason we do this, like the reason we talk about it is that not to terrify everyone and just leave them be terrified, but it's actually it's very empowering. Because once you know what information is there, you can start taking steps into removing this information and have more control of your digital footprint, which also helps in minimizing the people's access to your information. And there are so many ways we can do that. And in the discussion later, the questions, we can talk about some of them. I want to pause for now.
Thank you. Paula, to the extent that you can. Paula's a journalist as well and has experienced all of these things, I think. So I wanted to have her talk about, you know, how she's experienced it in her reporting.
Sure. Hi. Yes. So I'm from Puerto Rico, and I've done some stories there. I just wanted to talk about kind of how that reporting went. It's Hurricane Maria and the barrage of other hurricanes after, as well as earthquakes, was an extremely traumatizing event. For myself personally, but my sources, to cover these stories, I try to like approach, weave a little care into the reporting. I flew into Puerto Rico. I'm based in Brooklyn. So flew into Puerto Rico. I was working on a story about this town it's called Guayama, that has like a huge coal ash plant It's like a 5-story like mountain of coal. After Hurricane Maria, aside from the hurricane itself and the trauma of the hurricane, it compounded issues that the community there was living. The proximity to the coal ash plant allowed a lot of people were sick over years of exposure to that. So there's a large amount of people that have cancer, a lot of people that have asthma, and other a plethora of health issues. I feel like I wish I had, you know, in journalism school a bit more tools to know how to manage talking to someone that's traumatized to be able to like navigate and tell their story, with the, like a wonderful context we have here. I feel like a crucial thing, especially covering climate, where, you know, natural disasters can be incredibly traumatizing for people. Communities at the margins are often more disproportionately, affected by climate change, natural disasters. By not like approaching these stories with the proper care, there's so many stories that are left untold. Going back to my reporting, I flew into Puerto Rico and spoke with some of the community members there. And I think it's very important. A few things that I really wanted to stress in terms of how I approached double down on like informed consent. They're sharing something that's, they're very vulnerable, being very vulnerable with you, which is very kind for as a journalist. Or on the side of like expressing everything, the process of whether you're on the record, on background, allow them to take breaks. A lot of the times it's a heavy subject. It's something that's, you're talking to people at perhaps some of the worst moments in their life and how they got through that. Allow them the space. As journalists, I feel like we often don't want to give power in an interview. Like, we don't want to, we want to be asking the questions and be able to steer the conversation. But often in these kinds of stories, I think it's good to leave it open-ended and also give the source some power in that dynamic of interviewing in order to respect them and be able to tell their story more effectively. I, as journalists, we're not immune to feeling some of these effects. In this instance, I'm very personally, I'm very close to this kind of story of Puerto Rico, Hurricane Maria. I think it's like being aware that you also need to take care of your source, but also yourself. Give yourself some space to unwind and kind of debrief the conversations. I think we can chat later.
Yeah, awesome. I just want to put a little bug in people's ears too about something that jumped to mind when all three of you were talking, and that is that I know I've had the experience of doing stories on extreme weather events, mostly fire, when I was living in California. And there's very much this kind of rule that
you know, you are supposed to keep a certain amount of distance, you know, you don't want to get involved in your source's lives, all of that kind of stuff, right? So I had this experience of getting sent to a shelter that people were being sent to in a fire, and met this woman who, you know, was total, like, deer in the headlights, had run from her house with her baby who only had a diaper on to get out of a fire. And I was like, you know, hi, you know, would you talk to me about? And she was like, yeah, I'll talk to you. And then we started talking for a while, and she, I asked her how old her son was, and she said, oh, he's 2. And I said, oh, you know, my youngest is 2 at the time. And she was like, do you have any diapers in your car? Do you have any clothes? Do you have this? And I, in that instant, I was like, yeah, fuck yeah, I have diapers. Like, come back to my car, you know? And afterwards, I had to, like, have this very long, complicated conversation with my editor about it and, like, whether or not that was okay and things like that. And I personally think that this is something we kind of need to maybe rethink as... Like, as we start to cover more and more extreme events like this, how do we think through the ways that, like, the rules of journalism might need to shift a little bit to accommodate, like, very new types of situations that we're in? I know not everybody agrees with that, and that's fine. We can talk about it. But for me, I was like, I am not going to be like, no, I don't have diapers to this lady, you know? I want to hear from both Gigi and Rebecca about some things that you might want to recommend to the folks here, especially the journalists, for dealing with these things, you know, behaviors or protections, ways to think through some of this stuff. And then we'll open it up for Q&A after that.
So I wanted to just repeat one thing, like a couple of things that Rebecca said. The first thing was when we're talking about the window of tolerance, and I'm going to come back to that, and its relation to safety. But also when Rebecca said the internal resources and external support. This is of the biggest ever. Mm. Actually providing support to someone and to build your own internal resources, we do need people. We need the support of everyone around us, whether family, friends, whoever you choose to be the person or the group that supports you. But this also includes employers. And that's why I always bring it back up to newsrooms. But also, like, you can have your own support the way you like it, the way that works for you. And what I would like to say is choose the thing that works for you. There are so many tips and things and, like, things you can do to take care of yourself, things you can do to help you calm down, for example, or ground you. From my experience doing this work and working with journalists who are covering issues like that, is that not everything works for everyone. For me, for example, and when someone tells me to, like, deep breathing, that does not work for me. That stresses me out.
Same.
It's just like I now know that it's like this is not something for me. Yeah. So it's like if someone tells me to take deep breaths, it's like, no, this is really stressing me out very much now. So it's like, no. But I found out by trial what are the things that work for me. For example, I always love to carry a small bottle of perfume that I love. Hmm. It just brings me a sense of grounding, sense of safety, and look, like, you know, find the things that you're doing in a daily basis that brings you joy or yeah. brings you comfort. Whatever that is, use it. It's not a guidebook. You know, it's not like these checklists that you have to tick so that this is how you do self-care. Whatever works for you, try it and use it. And the thing is, like, with my therapist, we always talk about this. It's literally like training yourself and, like, training your muscles. Some stuff, like, As I said, like, for example, I love specific perfume or, like, specific smells, and it helps ground me. But I do that, and I remind myself with that in my actual, like when I am in my window of tolerance, when I am not hyper-aroused or, like, hyper-aroused. So that means that I am actually convincing my brain that this is something that brings me safety, that makes me feel safe, so that when I am in out of my window of tolerance, it's easier for me to recall that. Mm. You can do that with a memory. You can do that with anything that works for you. Deep breathing for whoever that works for. Yoga, anything that makes you feel connected and makes you feel safe and grounded, this is something that you want to try and find the things that work for you and, like, literally build up your muscles and, like, train yourself that these things you can recall easier when you are in distress, whatever that definition of distress. The other thing is, when we're talking about window of tolerance, I always find it important to mention to journalists that being outside of your window of tolerance can affect your physical safety massively, can put you in a lot of risk. Because in the field, older, not now, I mean, it's still a problem, talking about mental health is not very, very big. Now it's changing, but it's not still at the point that I would love it to be. But when we're at the beginning, when anyone was talking about mental health for journalists, it was like, journalists have a thick skin. These things don't affect us. We can do everything, and we do think that we are superheroes. But then when we're thinking about risks and you're doing a risk assessment or thinking about your own safety, this is where it comes as a problem, is that if I am doing a risk assessment, I am covering a wildfire. I am covering a flood. I am covering a protest. I'm covering a war. Whatever it is good for me to be in my window of tolerance so that I can assess my safety and my surrounding in a way that actually keep me safe. But if I am out of my window of tolerance, it's easier for me whether to miss some stuff, some threats, or to, if I am panicking, for example, I might actually find something risky that it's not. And journalists, and like, we fall into that a lot. Not actually not finding something risky, but like we undermine the risk. And specifically, if you're doing this for a long time, when it comes to online abuse, for example, if someone is receiving threats every single day, their risk tolerance changes, and their assessment of the risk and the threats, like, is this something that I should go to the police or not? Mm-hmm. We get used to seeing these things. We get used to reading them. But that does not minimize the threat. That does not minimize the seriousness of something that I'm receiving. But it actually affects my perception of what is a threat. And it's very important to have that in mind when we're doing our work, because we get used to it. We get desensitized. We're breathing all of these threats all the time. I'm receiving this on Twitter and Facebook and my email, so that I no longer have the best judgment when it comes to, this is the point I need to seek professional support. This is the point I should go to the police, or in some cases, the FBI, for example. So it's very important to keep that in mind. And going back to when we're talking about external support, being an ally is something that is very, very, very important. When someone is struggling with, for example, online abuse, there are so many ways that we can be allies and support each other in a way that is helpful. The first thing that anyone can do in all cases is to check in privately with the individual, no matter what the situation is. You can check in with the individual and ask them, provide them with a menu of options. What are the things that they feel they need? In situations of distress, sometimes people actually do not know exactly what they need. But if we are aware of the dangers, threats that we're receiving and others are receiving, we can have a checklist in our minds that, oh, I can monitor your social media accounts for you, and you can take a break from your phone so that you don't have to read all of the horrible things that you're receiving. I can help you tighten your privacy settings, and we can Google it together and walk you through how to do this. There is a lot of things that you can do for someone that is struggling, specifically with digital safety and online abuse, for example, that are options that you can provide for them, and they can choose from it. And that happens with, like, all of our colleagues. Almost every person I know who's a journalist have been at the receiving end of online abuse and horrible things that they receive in their inbox. And there are so many things that we can do to build our supportive community for that.
So I wanted to just add a couple of things to Amy's question, sort of about this woman who has diapers and what that asks and begs for about our own professional boundaries. And I want to say I think every single profession is engaged in this sort of interrogation now, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a teacher, whether you are, I was thinking about all the range, someone who works in the advertising industry, again, whether you're a clinician, I think the climate crisis, above all others, is asking of people, what are the boundaries? Again, which is why I started with being human first. And so when we go to do disaster reporting, do we cut off our sense of humanity? When we teach students in the high schools about climate education and the students start crying, how do we engage with them? Mm-hmm. For me as a clinician, do I bring up climate? Do I not bring up climate? What are the boundaries? I think that in all of these different professions, boundaries are starting to get questioned. And I think they need to. I don't have an answer to each and every single one of these because they're so deeply personal. They involve so many different kinds of questions about safety and longer-term connections with people. So I couldn't give an advice specifically about this woman with diapers. But I do absolutely think that we are all being called to ask, what are the boundaries of our work? If what is most fundamental is that we actually build something large enough to save our species, that's kind of boundary crossing. So I think that we need to actually really examine these questions, and we cannot answer them on our own, which is, I think, the second part in terms of how to deal with trauma. I absolutely agree with every single one of the things that was mentioned about how to sort of individually take care of one's own traumatic reaction, and I'm happy to talk individually with people. There's lots and lots of trauma resources. There's tons online that are actually really quite good. So there's a lot of things to talk about one's specific experiences of trauma. The underlying fact about all of those is how to re-engage and reconnect with your body. Part of the problem, and so often with trauma, is that people go into their heads and feel very, very, very disconnected from their present reality for all sorts of different reasons. So all of the different strategies, whatever works, is about how to reconnect you to your body, to your five senses, quite literally. And there's loads of different tools at the individual level for people to do with that. And that is partially why people go to therapists, quite literally, is to learn those tools. But therapists are not the only ones who know them. We can teach them. These are things that are not necessarily, again, rocket science. We just need to develop a culture, and that is my last part, a culture that talks about these things, a culture that validates these things as being real experiences, that don't make you biased, that don't make you a less good journalist, that in fact make you more connected to the work and more able to respond. And so then thinking a little bit more about collective solutions. Again, yes, the individual work is necessary, but what about the newsroom culture where people don't feel like they can talk about it, where they can't admit it, where they're afraid to say their names, all of these other kinds of things? How do we change the newsroom culture? How in our articles do we emphasize, if you're reading about this, you might be feeling anxious, you might be feeling upset, here's something you can do about that? How do we acknowledge that what we're writing about, what we're reading about, is raising all sorts of different feelings? So again, a collective solution, ultimately, is the most important one, changing the culture, but then obviously the collective solution dealing with climate change in the first place, right? So it's all the way up and through. So yes, there's lots and lots of individual strategies. The DART Center for Trauma and Journalism has a lot of stuff online about how to work with sources who've been traumatized. We can have lots and lots of conversations about that if you want. But again, it's really about allowing the feelings to emerge, talking about them, creating space for them, and not creating a sense of shame or that it's not part of our professional obligation. And again, the boundaries, I think they all need to shift.
I'm just going to bring the mic around if people have questions. And the rule is journalists first and journalists orgs and no speeches.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Solis. I'm a reporter for the Nevada Current. This spring and summer, I'm going to be reporting on the massive snowpack that's collected around Nevada and California. Unfortunately, that also means huge flooding statewide. There's already been $20 million of damage in rural Nevada communities so far this spring. So when I'm interviewing people who, you know, have had these floods within their community, have lost or had damaged homes, I guess I sort of want a step-by-step instruction on how to do that.
I think there's no, like, step by step that I could say. Because I think, yeah, it really depends. But I think it's really important to build trust with your sources, especially when they're talking about something that's so, sensitive. I think just being very clear and, or on the side of over-explaining your process and what the story's going to be, so that you don't want to, I hate to say, I guess we traumatize them in the process of reporting the story. And, often I feel that people that go through trauma, they're robbed of their sense of control, power, and, ensure that you're through your storytelling, ensure that you're and through them sharing their story, they're kind of regaining that power, and I think it's part of the process of healing and moving on from that. I think, but in terms of things to do, I think just be very explain a lot, and then give them space. If they don't immediately want to talk, it's happened to me that someone doesn't want to talk to me in the moment, and I give them my business card or my info, and then when they're ready, they might reach out if they want to share their story. So just being really respectful. I think it's a little bit of a dance of maneuvering the specific situation and source. I think that would be my recommendation.
I would say too, I'm sorry, time is your friend. Plan to spend a good chunk of time with people. Small talk, totally your friend. Let people feel comfortable before you start asking really hard questions. And I feel like that's something, again, that is I don't know. I know a lot of journalists that are just get in there and ask your questions and da-da-da. And I just don't think that you're going to get anywhere doing that in this situation. Sorry.
I think directly following on that is that one of the things that happens when people experience trauma is their sense of narrative really changes. Mm-hmm. And so what can look like inconsistency, what can look like forgetfulness, what can look like sort of not wanting to answer questions are very much trauma responses. And so trauma doesn't look any one thing. Some people can be hyperverbal, other people can be very shut down. And so in the world of investigations, which I used to do around sexual assault, et cetera, the linear quality of policing and the linear quality of investigations did not comport with how survivors experienced their assaults. I would say probably the same is true for journalists who have to go in and get information and get a narrative, a beginning, middle, and end. The whole rupture of trauma is that it destroys people's sense of beginning, middle, and end in all sorts of different ways. And so imposing that kind of structure on the interview can be really, really difficult, especially if you come at it with a feeling that they're doing something wrong, that they're not trying to answer you, that they're being evasive. So there's lots and lots of things to talk about just in terms of how does a traumatized person show up, and how do they experience themselves? And so I think that would very much be about trauma-informed journal, how to engage somebody in those contexts. One other thing very concretely, and Paola talked about this already, and you talked about this in terms of safety, is first and foremost, reassure them again and again and again that they have the right to change the circumstances of the interview at any time. They can stop the interview at any time, that their safety is ultimately what's most important, their sense of efficacy is what's most important, the news story comes last. And ironically, of course, that will probably mean that they will share more because they feel safe. But nevertheless, it really does need to come last in that regard. And I know that violates certain journalistic ethics. There's all sorts of things in the clinical world that I'm saying that probably violate the clinical as well. Again, how do we respond in these situations is often our professional norms don't comport.
I want to add to that as well. There is a framework that is called psychological first aid that I really love using because I used to interview a lot of people who were tortured in prisons. And to have these conversations, they're very, very not easy. to have people open up, but also, like, I always struggled with the fact that, like, when you were talking about, informed consent, for me, if I, in regular story, ask someone once or twice, in these specific instances, I ask them, like, 10 times, but, like, not in a very, you know, overwhelming way, but I really want them to understand, and it's very important for me, for their well-being, for me as well as a journalist, to understand why I'm doing this. So I found that explaining why I'm doing this story helps. Like, these are the reasons why I'm covering this. This is why I care about it. Also, similar to Amy's point, like, it might be controversial sometimes. But for me, what you just added is that, like, to make sure that they're okay, to, like, just tell people that, are you okay? Make sure, like, I don't know. Like, for me, it's like, I don't want to interview someone while, like, for example, I'm not making sure that they have the food they need, like, they feel safe. If they have other needs, I personally would start by trying to make sure that this is happening, not necessarily from me. But if there are resources that you know of, for example, in a place of disaster, that you can connect them with, this is something good to do. But, like, also, going to the question, depending on the boundaries and, like, all of the things that we keep talking about. But, like, just explaining also, like, what you're doing, why you're doing it helps. Giving people breaks, giving, like, literally every couple of questions I would ask people, do you need a break? Do you want us to talk about something else? And then go back to the questions. Some people tell you, like, you know what? No, I want to talk about everything now. Other people are like, you know, I'm done. And it's okay. Like, for me, the human matters more than my story. So,
yeah. Hi, thank you. This is actually more of a suggestion around interviewing process. When you're interviewing people in traumatic situations or any time, is a process that I use around looping. So it isn't a constant peppering of questions. It is asking a question, listening, and then saying, I'm going to sort of play back to you what I've heard. Did I hear you right? Did I hear you? And letting that person then say to you, no, actually, that's not what I said. That's not what I did. So I find that looping process really helpful instead of that, what we can all do as journalists, which is the constant peppering of questions and not realizing that sometimes, to your point, Rebecca, in trauma, sometimes people just, they don't actually know the full answer and they are not necessarily themselves. So I just thought I would offer that.
More questions? Oh, sorry.
Thank you guys for this panel. So Paulo, you already know this, but climate justice is my jam. So this question is mostly for Rebecca and JJ. I was just curious to know, how is climate justice sort of showing up in trauma-informed journalism? Are you guys seeing justice, you know, folks sort of wanting to cover more justice issues? How do you think it's interrelating and intersecting in your work?
You know, I'm new to thinking a lot about this in the terms of in the context of journalism, but certainly in terms of trauma-informed care, it's unquestionable that the vast majority of people who are dealing with, particularly sources at this point, but I would also say journalists, the motivation to become an environmental journalist, the motivation to focus on this kind of work comes from one's own history, comes from one's experience. One brings a whole host of generational and traumatic histories. It's part of actually why I began at the beginning, because it actually provides insights that can be discussed and explored in articles that are not often seen as wisdom, that are often dismissed as being important sort of information. There was a really fascinating article that I read about solutions journalism in the context of local reporting, and how so many times the kind of reporting that traditionally happens overlooks the skills, the creativity, the collective solutions, the neighborhood-based resources that people have mobilized to be able to deal with some of the kinds of issues that they've dealt with in terms of environmental crisis. And because of the kind of disaster orientation and a sort of you bob in and bob out in terms of the reporting, that not only creates a kind of feeling that the story is literally extractive, but it also excludes the experience that people have gained through this through the process of surviving and managing to thrive and live and find joy in the context of trauma. So I guess I don't have an answer as a journalist because I'm not a journalist. But I do think the reason I began where I did is that the people who are on the front lines of experiencing endless amounts of generational and constant trauma, I don't want to romanticize it. I have zero interest in the language of resilience in a kind of simple way. But there are lessons to be learned from communities that have learned how to find collective solutions and to find ways of finding meaning that are absolutely essential and that don't get talked about in most of these articles, which is why I think the idea of constructive and solution journalism is a place to begin. Again, I'm feel a little bit hesitant because I'm wading into territory that is not mine, but I'm trying to understand the intersections between mental health, climate, justice, and journalism. So that's a beginning answer.
This is actually a very important question. When it comes to justice, it should be in everything, and when it comes to safety, it's very related. You cannot really separate them, because what we found is that if I'm talking only about online abuse and digital safety, for example, what we found is that people who are on the receiving end of online abuse, for the most part, are from specific identities. Mm. So we actually need to take that into consideration. We need to believe that this is the reality. Maybe a white male journalist will receive, be a part of campaign of online abuse against him because of an article. A black woman journalist doing this work, this has been part of her life almost every day. So not taking that into account is us living in denial, and it's not constructive to anyone, not newsrooms, not journalists, not anything. So I think in my personal belief, justice should be in the middle of everything. And when it comes to climate justice, this is a point that you said now. It's very important. This parachuting journalism is a problem. It's not necessarily between countries. It can be between states, between communities. So if you want to retain journalists of color, journalists from different identities, you do need to support them, because if all studies have proven that they are the ones on the receiving end of threats and abuse, you do need to take care of them. You need to provide the resources that should help them keep doing the work. But another point of it, which is also yes, parachuting journalism sucks, but, and you should definitely work with journalists from communities. But also one thing that is for me problematic is to go to the same person every single time to cover a specific story because of their identities. Don't box them. Mm. Let them choose. Someone should choose if I am from Egypt, if I want to be the one covering the Middle East, for example, or Egypt, I should choose to do that, not because I am Egyptian, but because I choose to do it. Yes, I might have better ideas and about the community and know more about the community, but my newsroom or my work should not box me into doing that because of who I am. You should let people choose. That also goes to the fact that people should not be covering traumatic events every single time. As a journalist, take a break. Cover dancing, art, whatever it is for one assignment. That's it. You need to take breaks because you do need to take care of your mental health, your well-being, but also you need to restore your sense of safety and risks so that you can keep doing that and not be at risks without intending to, because our sense of safety have been compromised. So I don't know if this answers exactly your question, but yeah.
Hi there. Thank you for this panel. It was really, really, really informative. You mentioned something that I thought was really helpful about how people numb out and how they kind of have stopped reading news in a lot of ways. And I think that's something that generally hasn't been covered at this conference. So I appreciate that. When you talked about having empowering your readers to have agency, are there ways that you guys have found success with that, either for your readers or for yourself? Maybe it's your own personal work in nonprofit advocacy or whatever it is, but I would love to get some insights on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question. Can you repeat it again? I'm sorry. It did stump me a little bit.
No, it's okay. Just if you have ways that you empower your readers to stay engaged and have agency, and then maybe how you do it yourself.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think just how we talked about solutions, I think is often, like, covering solutions is a good way to kind of empower readers on especially covering climate and environmental issues. The cliches, right? Gloom, doom and gloom. So when you're changing that narrative, I think even that is, like, myself as a reader reading more solution stories, it helps combat that sense of doom and futility, you know?
I would add to that what we were just talking about, like, actually working with people from the community so that you can have trust that you're not just, like, a big newsroom going to some place that had a disastrous event, covering it, and then, like, bye. So it's like working with people from the community helps in this. That's why, like, these all talks about local journalism and investing in local journalism is something very important. Not only that people will trust you, but also it will help in fighting disinformation and misinformation. Because you're working from people from the community. They will believe what you're saying more. But also, like, if that's not for you as a person, but, like, if there was more investment in local journalism, there will be a shift on how people see newsrooms. Another part of it is diversity and inclusion. And we cannot really ignore it, because, like, the more you see people talking about issues that represent you, people who look like you, people who believe like it just makes it more in touch with reality. And not only as, like, oh, I am here to cover this story and I'm done and I'm going. Also, you need to build relationships with communities. If you want to have, and cover good things. Like, you can cover, like, specific issues about in a certain geographical area. But if you only do that and not cover any good thing about that community or that area, people lose interest. You can cover the things that are happening that are disastrous, but you can cover the good things as well, the successes, and, like, make it more human.
Sorry, I keep changing around. Hi, guys, I'm back here now. I'll just add to that. I do love audio journalism, and I think it lends itself to actionable type stories because you can actually hear the voices of the people in the community. And there again, like, I always spend at least, like, a year in the, you know, in and going back and forth to the community of people that I'm reporting on to, like, get in there. And also usually try to prepare some kind of additional ancillary materials for people to be able to, like, download and share and, you know, share information at least. I feel like the least we can do as journalists is make it easy for people to like have the information that we're trying to give them. It doesn't have to be like, here's how you call your senator, you know, but like being a, like giving people easy ways to retain that information, I think is useful. Were you going to add something, Rebecca?
Well, I'm not a journalist, and so I really humbly and really respectfully the challenges of trying to give information to such large audiences in such constant ways is something that I'm feeling very humble about. But about the issue of agency, though, I guess to me one of the biggest problems is people's profound sense of isolation, and the consumption of news in isolation. And so when I think a lot in my, whether it's in my clinical work or when I think about it in terms of why I'm doing Climate Psychology Alliance, is trying to get clinicians who are already feeling, how do we as clinicians address the massive amounts of trauma that are out there? We need each other, right? And so I guess when I think about agency in isolation, it's that I think all stories need to emphasize that it is not about the individual per se. It is about relationship and connecting. And in whatever context people need to do, whatever context people are in, the answer is not going to be at 3 a.m. you know, hypervigilantly scrolling through. That is not going to be the solution,
lies.
Right? The solution, right? Or five in the morning, whatever it is, right? The solution is going to be connecting with others. And all of the data out there indicates that actually climate change is on people's minds. People do care, but they don't have an experience of that because they're not talking with each other about it. So they feel more and more isolated. And so again, I think when we think about agency, it's how to connect people with each other. That is ultimately what it means to be human. That is the most exciting thing about being human, not as consumers, but as people who connect and talk and think and feel and relate. Those are the kinds of things that we want stories to be about. Those are the things that make us have a sense of genuine hope about human beings' capacity to overcome some of this stuff. Again, I'm not a journalist, but if you can put all that stuff in your newspaper articles, it'd be awesome.
Okay, we have time for maybe two questions. Let's see, we did that side, so this side. Okay.
Thanks. Hi, I was wondering if you have tips on running a trauma-informed newsroom, like from an editor's perspective, things an editor can do to support their reporters.
Can you please repeat the question?
Info, like advice on how to run a trauma-informed newsroom.
So part of what I do with work is I work with newsroom leadership to set up best practices and policies to respond, for example, to online abuse and digital safety. The first thing, check in with humans. Like, talk to the people that you have is the biggest thing ever. Because, like, when you talk to them, if you build this connection and relationship of trust, and to know actually what are the problems, you can do that in a, like, you can run surveys that are anonymous about the issues that people are facing. Know that and then work with them. One of the things is provide people with mental health support, subsidized or covered by insurance. Like, any of these things actually help. Help people take breaks without it affecting their professional development. Like, make it a safe space for people to come and say that I am actually traumatized and burnt out, but I'm not, like, I'm worried that you're not going to be assigning me any more stories. Like, I think we need to break down this idea of thick skin in journalism. Yeah. Is that we're humans, we get tired, I need to take a break, I need to cover something that is not shootings, I need to cover something that is not floods, and then I will go back to that. That doesn't make me less of a journalist. It really makes me a human being, and that's it. So I think having this communication with people in your newsroom is something very important, and listening to what they need. I do acknowledge and understand resources in newsrooms, but there are so many things that people can do within newsrooms that has nothing to do with resources. Like, it's not really that you're investing a lot of money. Do people in this newsroom have places that they can report and escalate things that they're facing? Is even like the conversation of online abuse a thing that are people talking about in newsrooms? Having these discussions will make it easier and easier by time. It's not a magical solution that will tomorrow change it, but it's an effort. It's a thing that we add and work on every day with our colleagues at our newsrooms to make it like a more accessible conversation and support.
I don't have a whole lot to add to that. I think that that's absolutely right. I mean, I think your question was about trauma-informed for the journalists, the experience of journalists. Gotcha. So I think that answer was fantastic. And I think just the overwhelming comments that are coming from here is to normalize it as much as possible. Just as we hear articles about climate anxiety not being something pathological or trauma not being something pathological, that people's experience of this, of reporting, it's not a pathological response to be affected by it. It's why people become journalists in the first place, right? It's because they care about their world. They want to do things about their world. They want to report and impact their world. That should be a joy. That should be something, a gift to what they're offering as a journalist. And so it needs to be supported like anything else. And that, so I would say, absolutely, mental health care, breaks, diversity of articles that you're having to do. And I would certainly say more journalists, so that you're not forced to have to cover one thing very, you know, at the pace and volume that people have to do. So again, and the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma has quite a bit that I would really recommend looking at, and we can talk more about specific things if you're interested.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm kind of piggybacking off everything that was said. I think it's really, at least in my experience, it's been rare to have, I think, the support that I felt like I needed when reporting really intense topics or dealing with online harassment. So I'm glad that this conversation is one that's, you know, happening, and I hope, you know, the higher ups at newsrooms are able to give that support and space for journalists.
Hi, thanks so much. My name is Liza Gross, Inside Climate News. This has been a really great panel, and I really appreciate what the tips you're offering. We heard a lot about how to be sort of sensitive and make people comfortable, and I guess maybe this might be a question for Rebecca specifically, but are there things, like, from your practice and your experience as a clinician that are absolutely things we must absolutely avoid doing? Like, just don't make these mistakes kind of thing.
I once gave a talk to, believe it or not, police investigators who asked the question, how can I avoid traumatizing the survivor? And actually my answer was is that you can't always avoid it. And in some ways, the answer is not to look for all the things to avoid doing, but how to respond once it's happened. Because I could give you 8,000 different things not to do, but the one person in the room who was traumatized in a specific way, that would end up landing on them. And so I think the fact, which is why I want to go back, we are living in a really traumatized world. We're not talking just about climate, obviously. We're talking about police shootings. We're talking about police brutality. We're talking about all of these other things that people are feeling at a heightened level already pretty constantly. There's a brittleness that I'm sure everybody is feeling and all over the place. And so I don't know if there's things that one can say. But I would certainly, I mean, some of the obvious ones that we've sort of talked about, you don't force somebody to answer questions if they don't want to answer them. You don't close doors if they don't want doors closed. You offer, like, what is the best way to make you feel safe? Do you need water? Do you need to walk around? Do you need me to repeat questions? Do you want me to assume that most of the time, especially when someone's been traumatized, you need to repeat things a lot and say it in different ways? You need to have it in writing and you want to say it verbally. There's all sorts of different things. But certainly when you don't put people at risk, but you won't always know what causes them to feel risk, right? And so you just be responsive. So I guess what I would finally say is if you sense that they are uncomfortable, you don't push past it. You honor that, and you say, I'm sorry. You don't over-explain. I'm sorry, I clearly made you uncomfortable, and you walk away. Not walk away, but you pull away from the question, and you ask whether they need things to get resettled. It is in the responsiveness to their experience that matters, not the fact that you can avoid at all cost re-traumatizing somebody. I wish we could, but that's not living in the world.
I want to add one thing about that is to be, like, when we're talking about taking care of our own mental health and be aware of our own triggers, this is something that is very important, specifically how we show up in a place and who we are and how we relate to the topics that we're talking about. If I am aware of my triggers, I will be working a lot on how can I respond to my triggers. What are the things that I can do, specifically if I'm covering something that is really triggering for me and very personal for me. So, because, like, then sometimes it shifts that we put the burden of us being triggered on the person that we're interviewing. So just being aware of that and working on that and understanding our own triggers helps us try as much as possible as we can not to put our own triggers on others. Or, like, specifically if you're interviewing someone for a story.
All right, I think we're at time. Sorry, folks. Thank you all for coming, and the speakers were amazing, and everyone's questions were so good.